the bill would invest about $1 billion in projects around the first state. And one area you've been highlighting is projects that would address roads that are vulnerable to climate change. How many of these projects are there around the state that, could see action if this bill does wind up passing?
Overall, it's a $287 billion bill. And 90% of that bill will be monies will be apportioned on a formula basis. Mm-hmm. The other billions of dollars will be apportioned to states. They can apply for grants, mm-hmm. and like the most worthy projects, the most innovative, most creative, the projects that are best at addressing resiliency, mm-hmm. and not just. Do you remember what Einstein used to say? He used to say the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over and again and expect a different result. But what we want to do is encourage states to try some new approaches to making sure our roads, highways, bridges, especially in the day of this day and age with extreme weather, terrible weather, flooding weather. We're seeing a bunch of roads in Delaware today on our tour that in not just during the hurricane, not just during the nor'easter, but just maybe high tide and heavy rain, they're underwater. And not just once a year, but throughout the year.
I was going to say there are like a number of these kind of chronic hotspots in the first states that do see this on a regular basis, and all of them are ones that I guess frustrate people on a regular basis.
Well, there are, and we can abandon those roads in some places. I think DelDOT, a couple of places around the state where roads are underwater often. They've decided, and it's getting worse. They've decided just to abandon those roads and help people find other alternatives. In some cases, the roads we're going to look at a road down just outside of Lewis called New Road, mm-hmm. which is very close to the campus of the University of Delaware's. I used to be the College of Marine Studies. I call it the College of Earth, Wind, and Fire. But New Road is oftentimes underwater, and so there. I think there's. That's a road they're not going to abandon. They're going to try to find ways to raise the road, to build it higher, rebuild it higher.
And we have seen that work, even in this state, on other roads. The one that comes to my mind is Prime Hook Road, which DelDOT dealt with about 3 or so years ago. And it has not seen the same kind of chronic flooding that seemed regular before that work was done.
That was a combination not just of building off the road. That was a combination of actually doing some interesting things with creating a place for water to go, mm-hmm. and that's it's actually a very successful project in the National Wildlife Refuges. We have a bunch of them across the country. We have two in Delaware, but that project is actually cited as an example, mm-hmm. of how to work with Mother Nature and to restore the passage of water through the through that National Wildlife Refuge in the ways that Mother Nature used to have it. And when we just kind of like dammed it up and created a situation where we had a lot of flooding, and it's actually works now as it ought to. It's a nice success story.
Is the goal with this though, in looking at some of these roads that need this kind of assistance, is the idea to try and get to some of these, I guess for lack of a better term, shovel ready type of projects, ones that there are people are aware of, we know they're chronic, and they just need that attention sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm.
Save Delaware has a huge backlog on roads, highways, and bridges. And historically, the state has paid roughly for half of the cost of building, maintaining roads, highways, bridges in the first state. The federal government does the rest. Mm-hmm. So it's a shared responsibility. And in order for the federal government to come in with its share, the state has to pony up its share. Mm. And when the state does that, the federal government tries to help out as well. Unfortunately, we have not only a huge backlog here for Delaware, yeah. in roads, highways, bridges, we have about a $780 billion backlog across the country in work that needs to be done. And there's just an unwillingness on the part of the Congress, and in some cases this administration, previous administrations, to actually pay for things that we know we need. Mm-hmm. We know we need to invest more money in our roads, highways, bridges. There's just a reluctance to do that. And I've been one who said that historically we've paid for, at the state level and the federal level, for service transportation projects, roads, highways, bridges, we paid for it through user fees. The traditional user fee has been gas and diesel taxes, but there are others as well. I just bought a new car for my wife on her birthday this summer, and we had to pay a document fee, which was a couple of $1,000, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And for a state that has no sales tax, we do have an auto document fee that we use. It's one of the ways we generate monies for our roads, highways, bridges. But there's just not enough money. And we're seeing an induction of vehicles now, some, but more, a lot more later, electric-powered vehicles. They don't use any gas or diesel. Hydrogen-powered vehicles, they don't use any gas or diesel fuel. So the question is we have more and more electric and fuel cell-powered vehicles with hydrogen on the roads. How are we going to pay for our roads, highways, and bridges? And one of the beauties of our legislation that passed unanimously out of the Environmental Public Works Committee at the beginning of August is the idea of preparing for the day when we have fewer and fewer diesel and gasoline-powered vehicles on the road. And because we're going to need to maintain the roads. And the idea is to move toward a vehicle miles traveled approach, called VMT. There's about six or seven states across the country that are now in a pilot project. Delaware is one of those states. And I think California, maybe Utah, Oregon, there's several other states that are part of this. And eventually we're going to increase the number of states where they're trying this out so that at the end of the day, folks that are driving electric vehicle or hydrogen-powered vehicle, fuel cell vehicle, they're going to pay their fair share as well.
I was curious because, I mean, this kind of emphasis on resiliency, climate change as being part of a highway bill is a bit different. And I'm curious, is in some ways this an effort to kind of get toward a Green New Deal type of atmosphere, but do so with a smaller bite of the apple?
Yeah. When a new Congress was seated on January 3rd this year, and there were some new folks in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party were in the House, and they were pushing hard something called the Green New Deal.
Yeah.
And I was asked, was this something I was endorsing? I said, I want to help write the Green New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And part of doing that is the legislation that is a traditional five-year highway transportation bill. But we're including that in provisions there that actually will, as we build out the new generation of roads, highways, bridges, we're going to do so in a way that will reduce the incidence of sea level rise and the incidence of climate change and global warming. And that would be a good thing. The other thing is, it used to be that a primary source of carbon emissions in the air, which lead to global warming, climate change, extreme weather, but the primary source used to be for many years was coal-fired utility plants. We got, until not that long ago, 40% of our electricity was from coal-fired utility plants. They put a lot of carbon dioxide into the air. We have more carbon dioxide, higher levels of CO2 in the air right now than we've ever had, ever. We've been able to go back and measure like hundreds of thousands of years back in time, and this is the highest it's ever been. There used to be a guy named Willie Sutton, who was a bank robber during the Great Depression. People would say they finally caught him and had him before the judge. At his trial, the judge said to him, Mr. Sutton, why do you rob banks? And he says, that's where the money is. And one of the reasons why we focus on reducing emissions, fuel emissions, carbon emissions, other emissions from cars, trucks, and vans is that's the highest source of carbon emissions that we have. So we have to work there first. And while we're working on this transportation bill, this highway bill, I'm also working to try to get about 15 automakers and 50 states to agree on fuel efficiency standards to reduce emissions of, among other things, carbon dioxide, so that we're not just addressing the symptoms of the problems, we're actually going to go after the root causes and to do both at the same time.
Yeah, so you're mentioning vehicles. I wanted to kind of get into this a little bit as well. There's money in this bill for electric vehicle and alternative vehicle charging stations. And I'm curious about this because EVs do seem like such a chicken-egg proposition, right? I mean, we did some reporting recently that indicated that Delaware, between the public and private charging stations that are available, now has addressed kind of the idea of range anxiety. You can go around the state, and if you need a charging station, there should be one that's reasonably close to you. But we also found that some of the private folks who have them, the Royal Farms, for example, that have them at their stores, say they're not getting a whole lot of use. And some people are suggesting, well, the key is actually to get more people to invest in buying these cars, mm-hmm. And perhaps look at things like vehicle-to-grid technology that might show people that, hey, if you have an electric car at your home and you have this technology, it's also helping you with dealing with your electric at home. It's not just your car. And I'm curious how you see that balance of which comes first. Do we need more charging stations to get people to buy more electric vehicles, or do we need to get more people to buy electric vehicles to need the charging stations to actually be used?
Great question. I was on the phone last week with a woman named Mary Barra, B-A-R-R-A. She's the CEO of General Motors.
Hmm.
And I was talking to her about whether or not General Motors might want to join a number of other auto companies in a 50-state agreement with California and 49 other states, including Delaware, on reducing auto emissions, fuel efficiency, improving fuel efficiency standards. And she said to me, Here at General Motors, we've worked for years. She's been there for many years. She said, we've worked for years to reduce emissions, harmful emissions, including carbon dioxide, from our cars, trucks, and vans, working on the internal combustion engine. She said, we've gotten just about all the improvements out of it that we can get.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of reducing emissions, for improving performance, she said, there's just not much more to get. And she said, the future is electric. And she said, that's what we're betting on, and that's where we're going. And she said, we've done a lot of surveying among our customers across the country and asking what are their concerns. And she said, among the concerns are, one, price, initial mm-hmm. price, and it's important that we, she said, it's important that it was continue, at least for a while, the tax credit that
right.
people get when they buy an electric vehicle. So the other thing is that range anxiety.
Right.
She said, 300 miles seems to be like the magic number for people, for most people. And I know for myself, when oftentimes I take the train to Washington. Tomorrow I'll go to Washington, and we'll start off the day in Wilmington, go to Smyrna, have a kickoff from school and big celebration,
right.
welcome back to school at Smyrna School District, and then we'll drive over to Washington, D.C., and then back up. It's about 250 miles, roughly,
right.
about 250-mile drive tomorrow. And there aren't many electric-powered vehicles that will get that for you. And so for me, it's funny because we just bought a new car for my wife, bought a highly energy-efficient Honda, which is largely made in the U.S. And but we looked at a lot of vehicles, including electric vehicles, didn't find anything that had maybe a Tesla that will
right.
get you to 300, but they're pretty expensive. And but really cool car, really cool cars. But she said, we're getting better. We're getting better to this. The Chevrolet Volt, which first came out 12 years ago, car of the year, got 38 miles on a charge. It's a hybrid. So you're 38 miles on a charge, and then you're on gasoline engine. That 2 years ago, the car of the year was the Chevrolet Bolt, all electric. It gets 240 miles on a charge. So I think that's a huge improvement. And I think we're getting to the place where there was range anxiety concerns are going to go away. And she says, what we need now is to make sure that there are even more, especially when people travel outside of their neighborhoods or outside mm-hmm. of their towns or communities, that they know as they travel across the state or across the country, they'll be able to get not just find a place to get through a battery charge, but get it charged quickly, speedily,
right.
so they're not wasting a lot of time.
Fair enough. There's a lot of other pieces to this bill. Are there one or two that kind of stand out to you that people should know about in terms of what this bill would be able to do if it passed in terms of improving transportation infrastructure?
There's an old saying, when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. And we have about a $780 billion backlog. And we're told every year by the National Association of Civil Engineers who evaluate the quality of our roads, highways, bridges, we're called the conditions like a D. D is in Delta, not our dog, not very good grade, and that we need to do something about it. The one thing that's not in this bill that needs to, as we go through the legislation, go through the legislative process, my committee, Environmental Public Works Committee, focuses on roads, highways, bridges. There is another committee called banking mm-hmm. that focuses on the transit piece here in Delaware, DART, and SEPTA, and so forth. There's another committee called commerce that focuses on rail and aviation.
Sure.
And there's another committee called finance that helps figure out how do we pay for this stuff. So the four committees need to be in concert, working together, combined our efforts into a joint bill. So for us to pass out unanimously and hopefully pass in the Senate next this fall, a $280-some billion highway bill, that's not the whole ball game. We have to do the other pieces, transit, rail, air, ports and stuff, and we have to figure out how to pay for it. And that's the challenging part. I find that most people are willing to pay for stuff that they use, and we call that a user fee approach. And we need for constituents to say to their legislators, in this case their federal legislature, and then that's the state too, I'm willing to pay a little bit more money because I want better roads, highways, and bridges. And so that is still to come. But the other thing I want people to know that I think my committee needs to set an example. We need to be bipartisan. We reported this bill out a large bill and addresses climate change at the same time. It provides for better roads, highways, bridges. But we did a bipartisan, unanimous bill. And I think the idea is to try to set examples to the three other committees of jurisdiction so they say, well, if they can actually work together in the Environment and Public Works Committee, maybe we can do that in the whole Senate and maybe in the House as well. The president, the day that we reported our bill out that morning, unanimously, he put out a tweet. It was very complimentary of our efforts because that was bipartisan and referenced the importance of transportation infrastructure. And so this ought to be one area where we can work together. And to that, I would say amen.
I do want to hit a couple other things off topic before we let you go. One is the trade war with China. How concerned are you with the direction it's taken over the past week or so and the tenor of President Trump's approach to this kind of burgeoning problem?
The president, I watched a little bit on television. I saw the president, and I think he was in the Rose Garden. Maybe he was getting ready to go on his G7 trip to France. And he said, no president, no other president ever did anything out to take the Chinese on. They were bad actors. They tried to steal our secrets, and they wouldn't let us sell our products to them, and they tried to, you know, put a whole lot of pour their products into our markets. We wouldn't do anything for years. Actually, the last administration negotiated a 14-nation deal on the Trans-Pacific Partnership with 13 other nations. Together, we were like 40% of the world trading bloc in this hemisphere, Canada all the way down to Chile, and over in Asia as well. The one country that was not included was China, because they're a bad actor and they don't play by the rules. And so you'd think a new administration would come in and embrace the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which excludes China, punishes them for their bad behavior, and allows us to be part of a 14-nation trading bloc that will strengthen us many ways in our economy. And this administration, the Trump administration, pulls us out of it. Makes no sense. It was one of the smartest things that the Obama administration did, and we walked away from it, which is crazy. Now we're in this trade tariff war with China. It creates great uncertainty for our businesses. Businesses need certainty and predictability, and we're seeing turmoil in the markets, turmoil in the marketplace, and this is not what we need. It's not what the president needs. He's getting bad advice, and he got really bad advice in pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And if it's frankly, unfortunately, it's like Humpty Dumpty. Now that, you know, we've broken the eggs, it's how do you recreate it? We really, really screwed up and lost a great opportunity.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was gun legislation in the wake of the recent mass shootings. Been a lot of discussion about that. How optimistic are you when Congress gets back to work? Something, whether it be red flags, background checks, something would be moving forward on Capitol Hill.
I was born in West Virginia. My dad, my grandparents, great hunters. My dad was a gun collector. Bought and sold guns his last years of his life when he and my mom settled in Florida. My dad was a big proponent of the Second Amendment, but he also felt that we had to be careful about not selling guns to people that are unsafe, people are unstable, people are dangerous. The idea of having not selling, allowing people to have access who are unstable, mentally unstable, who have a tradition or history of violence, including gun violence, that they could get access to guns over the internet or at a gun show or something like that. And my dad would say that's crazy. We've got to be smarter than that. The president is sort of hot and cold on this. And some days he's for stronger background checks. Other days he's not. Depends on who he's talked to last. Most people in this country think that we ought to strengthen our background checks. Still be respectful of the Second Amendment. We can do both, and we ought to do both.
Senator, we appreciate the time. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you. Great to see you, Tom. All the best.